Welcome back to the Bereans Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner. We are in module number 7 on the Apostolic Mission. This will be lesson number 28, which is the 15th part in the series dealing with the ministry of Paul. We completed last time chapter 20 of Acts, and where Paul was leaving the Ephesian elders after letting them know that he had they would not see him again. Now, we learned earlier that it was actually in Ephesus that the Apostle Paul first became aware in the Spirit, that is, in his communion with God through by means of the Holy Breath, he became aware that he was going to go to Jerusalem and that something not very good was going to happen to him in Jerusalem, and also his desire to see Rome. But what we see beginning in, go back to chapter 19 for just a moment. Excuse me. In verse 21, it says, when these things were accomplished, Paul purposed in spirit, when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, to go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. So we see that Paul, it says he purposed to go to Jerusalem. We also saw that in chapter 20, excuse me, in verse 16, it says Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, that he was stopping in the next port. For he was hurrying to be at Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. So Paul is hurrying. And then, of course, when he's at Miletus here, he sends for the elders of Ephesus to come to him. And then he gives the speech, which we went over last week. He says in verse 22 in that speech, he says, see, now I go bound in the Spirit to Jerusalem. And again, this is, Paul had a compulsion in his spirit to go to Jerusalem for the day of Pentecost, because he knew that the holy breath of God was letting him know that his ministry was coming to an end, and that he needed to be in Jerusalem on Pentecost, because something very powerful was going to happen in Jerusalem on Pentecost. So he says, I go bound in the Spirit to Jerusalem, not knowing the things that will happen to me there, except, now notice this, except that the Holy Spirit testifies in every city, saying that chains and tribulations await me. So the holy breath of God was speaking not only to Paul about the fact that he was going to be in chains and bound, that is, he was going to be arrested and imprisoned when he got to Jerusalem, but the Holy Spirit, holy breath of God, was also using others to drive this message home, that Paul was on this this compulsion that he needed to get to Jerusalem, and that these things awaited him in Jerusalem. Well, as he left Ephesus, he said to them that, you know, they were going to see his face no more. Paul was convinced that his time was very short, and that whatever happened in Jerusalem was going to be the beginning of the end for him, for his life. And so he said to the Ephesian elders that they would not see him again. That is, in the flesh. They would not see him again in this lifetime, that is. And so he turned over responsibility of the Ephesian churches to those elders, and he charged them with that responsibility. All right, so, excuse me, let's pick up chapter 21 now. Verse 1. Now it came to pass that when we had departed from them, that is from the Ephesian elders, and set sail, running a straight course, we came to Kos, the following day to Rhodes, and from there to Patara. and finding a ship sailing over to Phoenicia, we went aboard and set sail. When we had sighted Cyprus, we passed it on the left, sailed to Syria, and landed in Tyre. Tyre's on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea there, up from Caesarea. And finding disciples, we stayed there 7 days. It's interesting that wherever Paul's going now, at least back in the region of Syria, just north of Jerusalem, Judea, they're running into other apostles. He ran into other disciples of Christ. Remember in Ephesus, he ran into some disciples of John. So it's clear that the message is spreading everywhere, and it's not only because of the Apostle Paul's ministry. See, these are disciples that Paul didn't, you know, he didn't preach to these guys and they were converted by him. Other people did. Remember back in Acts 8, Philip, one of the deacons in the Jerusalem church, went up to Samaria and was preaching the gospel in Samaria, and many people were converted. So, you know, it's not just the Apostle Paul who is creating all these converts, but Christianity is multiplying. Many of the new converts are going out there and bearing witness as well and preaching the gospel as well. And so, the, you know, the early Christian congregations, they're exploding all over the Roman Empire. Now, yes, Paul was a big driver behind that movement because he went in faraway places and planted the gospel and planted churches, but then those churches spread out and the gospel spread out from there as well. So it's exploding all over the empire. But anyway, it says that in Tyre, it says, finding disciples, we stayed there 7 days. Now notice this next statement. They told Paul through the Spirit not to go up to Jerusalem. When we had come to the end of those days, we departed and went on our way. Now, you know, that might, you might get the impression from that, that when it says they told Paul through the Spirit not to go up to Jerusalem, it's not that the Spirit of God was telling Paul through these people, don't go to Jerusalem. All right, it's that they had insight by the Spirit of God concerning the things that were awaiting Paul in Jerusalem, the fact that he was going to be bound in chains and these issues were going to take place. And so they, because of their love for Paul, they're asking Paul, don't go. We know through the Spirit that these bad things are going to happen to you. Don't go. Please don't go to Jerusalem. But Paul is absolutely driven to go. All right, so verse 5. When we had come to the end of those days, we departed and went on our way, and they all accompanied us with wives and children till we were out of the city. So at the outside of the city, it says, and we knelt down on the shore and prayed. So together they accompanied him, with even with their wives and kids, they all accompanied Paul to the outskirts of the city of Tyre. And then they all knelt down on their knees and had a prayer meeting. Of, because no doubt of what was going to befall Paul when he finally got to Jerusalem. And when we had taken our leave of one another, we boarded the ship, and they returned home. And when we had finished our voyage from Tyre, now they're going down south, down the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, the far eastern side of the Mediterranean Sea, they're going down the coast. We came to Ptolemais, greeting the brethren, and stayed with them one day. So here's another town that's not mentioned about the gospel going there or churches being planted there or anything. But yet they're going from town to town, and they're finding groups of Christians in these various towns just going down the coast. We stayed with them one day. On the next day, we who were Paul's companions departed and came to Caesarea. Now, Caesarea was a large city. It's named after Caesar. So you can see, you know, as since all of this area is under the control of the Roman Empire, if they name a city after Caesar, the emperor, then it's a very important city. And it was an important port city. A lot of commerce there. All right, but this city is right on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, just parallel to Jerusalem. So if you wanted to get to Jerusalem by sea, that is on the Mediterranean Sea, you would land in Caesarea. That's the port where you would go, because that would be the closest large port where shipping would be going in to the city of Jerusalem. And then you'd go on foot going east, and you'd go to Jerusalem, which was not that far away. All right, so we departed and came to Caesarea and entered the house of Philip, the evangelist, who was one of the seven, and stayed with him. Now, when it says that Philip was one of the seven, it's referring back to early in Acts, we learned that they chose seven men to be deacons in the church in Jerusalem. All right, so Philip is one of the deacons of the church in Jerusalem, and this is the same Philip who was the one who went up and preached the gospel in Samaria in Acts chapter 8, where all those people were converted and baptized, and then they had to send Peter and John up so that they could receive the spiritual gifts by laying hands on them. You may remember that. All right, so he had, who was one of the seven and stayed with him. Now this man had four virgin daughters who prophesied. So Philip's daughters had the gift of prophesying, the gift of prophecy. You may remember that Philip had spiritual gifts as well that were no doubt imparted to him either on the day of Pentecost or by the apostles. Because in Acts 8, you know, it was because of the miraculous things that Philip was doing that the Samaritans believed the gospel, right? So his four daughters also had spiritual gifts. They had the gift of prophesying. And as we stayed many days, a certain prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. Now this is a prophet, is a person with the gift of prophecy, one of the gifts that were given on the day of Pentecost and were also given through the hands of the apostles. When he had come to us, he took Paul's belt, I guess he just, you know, kind of just ripped it off of him, bound his own hands and feet, and said, "Thus says the Holy Spirit," or Holy Breath, quote, "So shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles." So now these prophecies, you see, it said earlier that, you know, Paul said that in every city the Holy Spirit is testifying that bonds and chains are awaiting me in Jerusalem. And, you know, we saw what happened back at Tyre, how they're begging Paul not to go because through the Spirit they knew that something was going to happen to him. Now it's getting very specific. These prophecies about what's going to happen to Paul are getting very specific, right? He's going to be bound in chains. And not only is he going to be bound in chains, that means imprisoned, but he was going to be delivered over to the Gentiles. Now, what that means, the Gentiles would be the Roman authorities, because Rome, the Roman Empire, had control of this whole area. So the authorities, the legal authorities, the authority, authority to bind someone, keep them in prison, or even worse, execute them, was the Romans, was, you know, in the hands of the Roman courts. All right, so verse 12. Now when we heard these things, and when Luke says we, he means himself, Luke, and the other companions, traveling companions of Paul, and as well as, you know, those people who were here with Philip and his daughters and all that. All right, so it says, when we heard these things, both we and those from that place pleaded with him not to go up to Jerusalem. You know, you see this. You see this struggle going on here. Paul is absolutely determined that he has a mission to complete. And that mission is going to take him through Jerusalem. And that when he gets to Jerusalem, things are going to change. Because instead of being a free man, able to go wherever he wants and proclaim the message of the gospel, he was going to be bound and imprisoned. But this struggle that's going on between Paul's determination to finish his mission, no matter what it cost him personally, And all those in all these various congregations who loved the Apostle Paul because of all that he had done in spreading the gospel and all he had done for them. And they plead with him, don't do it, don't go, because they wanted to keep Paul to themselves. They wanted to keep him there to teach them and to train them and to be an active influence. And they thought, you know, maybe if Paul lives to be a very old man, that he'll have a much greater influence, you know, over the decades than if he, you know, if he goes and he gets arrested and he put on trial and he ends up being executed. But see, God's plans are not always our plans, and God's thoughts are not our thoughts. And the way that a man of God can be most effective in the mission that God has given him very often does not involve, you know, just continuing doing what he's doing, you know, until he's 90 years old. Sometimes it involves something more drastic and something that might cost him his life even, or at least imprisonment. And as we'll see as we continue the book of Acts, what happened in Jerusalem had a very, very profound effect on the spread of the gospel, as we'll see in a little while. Plus, when Paul's arrested in Jerusalem, he ends up being bound and shipped off to Rome eventually, after going back to Caesarea, then shipped off to Rome to stand trial before Caesar. But Paul's time in Rome at the end of Acts, which we're almost there, by the way, but Paul's time in Rome was very, very productive with regard to the spread of the gospel in Rome and then going out from Rome. But anyway, we'll get to that in the next few weeks. All right, so I think we were in verse, let's go back to verse 13. You've got all these people pleading with Paul not to go. Then Paul answered, "What do you mean by weeping and breaking my heart?" Oy vey! This is what he's doing. "For I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." In other words, this doesn't frighten me. Being bound with chains, being imprisoned, that doesn't frighten me. Because, you know, the prophecy was that you're going to be bound and imprisoned. It doesn't say he was going to die. But Paul is saying, not only am I ready to be bound and imprisoned at Jerusalem, but I'm ready to die at Jerusalem if that's what God calls for. I'm ready to die at the end of this trip to Jerusalem, is what he's saying. You know, it's one thing to say, I'm ready to die for Jesus. But how about, I'm ready to die for Jesus tomorrow? That's a different story, isn't it? Well, Paul was ready. So, verse 14, "So when he would not be persuaded, we ceased, saying," quote, "the will of the Lord be done." Now, you can see clearly here that Paul was following the will of the Lord for him. And these other people who were trying to persuade him not to go were not really following the will of the Lord. They were following what they, their own personal desires and what they thought would be best. But the will of the Lord was much more complex. The will of the Lord, because God can see the future, because God knows what will happen, and because God's plan is perhaps not fully understood by us, right? Or by them in this case. They didn't understand all that God had in store for Paul. Not only that, they didn't understand all of the effects that what happens to Paul was going to have on others. He had an effect on Roman officials who heard his trial, heard his case. He had an effect on the Jews and the synagogues in Rome. He had an effect, a wide-reaching effect on many very powerful people because of his arrest at Jerusalem, as we'll see as we continue. All right, so let's pick it up in verse 15. "And after those days, we packed up and went to Jerusalem. And some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us, and brought with them a certain Mnason of Cyprus, an early disciple, with whom we were to lodge. And when he had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. Now, apparently, this guy Mnason was he was of Cyprus, but it says we were going to lodge with him, so obviously he had a place in Jerusalem as well. So when they got there, they would have a place to stay. And when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And this is the congregation at Jerusalem. On the following day, Paul went in with us. Now notice this. To James, and all the elders were present. Paul met with the leadership of the church at Jerusalem. Now it doesn't say that the other apostles were present. Now this James here is not James, the brother of John, who was one of the 12 apostles. This James is the brother of Jesus. Now, the James who was the brother of John was killed early in Acts by Herod Agrippa, after which he imprisoned Peter, and then Peter was, you know, Peter, that's when the angel came and Peter got out of prison. This James was the brother of Jesus, and he is also the James who wrote the book of James in your New Testament. And he was also the brother of Jude, who was his younger brother. Jude wrote the book of Jude. So you've got two books in your New Testament that were written by physical brothers of Jesus that were sons of Mary, Jesus' mother. All right, Jesus being the oldest. Anyway, it says the elders were present. Now, you may remember it. We read earlier about James and the elders gathering together, and that was at the Jerusalem Council. That was back in chapter 15 when Paul and Barnabas, after their first missionary journey, and they had all this trouble with the Jews who were spreading their false message that Gentile converts, must be circumcised and keep the law of Moses, including observing the Sabbath, including the kosher laws, you know, the food laws, including all the requirements that were put on the Jews under the law of Moses. These guys were coming out of the Jerusalem church and teaching that you know, a Gentile who wants to become a Christian, he's got to basically become a Jew in order to be a Christian. And, you know, Paul, they had that big, you know, fracas about that. And then Paul and Barnabas went up to Jerusalem to get the church in Jerusalem, the leadership of the church in Jerusalem, to overturn that, or to put a stop to that false teaching. And you remember that they met together, and James and the elders, and Peter was also present. They put together that letter that said that the Gentiles did not need all that the Gentiles were required to do, basically, as far as eating laws concerned, what God had commanded Noah, right? That was, you could eat any kind of an animal, you just can't eat the blood, right? And to abstain from fornication, and to abstain from all forms of idolatry, anything at all that smacks of idolatry, right? Paganism. They were to stay away from that. And those are the requirements that they put on the Gentiles. But the Jews, because they said that the Gentiles, that's all the Gentiles need to do, that doesn't mean that the Jews now could, you know, in Jerusalem, and the Jerusalem church would suddenly say, okay, well, we're not going to observe the festivals anymore. We're not going to observe the Sabbath anymore. We're not going to keep the kosher laws anymore. And we're going to stop circumcising our children. No, the Jewish church, the Jewish Christians, continued to observe the festivals. They continued to worship on the Sabbath day. They continued to, you know, eat kosher. They continued to do the things that were required by the law of Moses as well. All right, as well as following the teachings and commands of Christ. But the Gentiles were not required at all to participate in those things that the law of Moses had imposed on the Jewish nation. All right, so He says in verse 19, when he had greeted them, that is James and the elders, he told in detail those things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. I'm sure that was a long talk because there was so much to report. I mean, just the book of Acts that we've read here, you know, the last number of chapters that deal with Paul's ministry only touches, you know, it's the tip of the iceberg of all that actually happened. There are many places in the book of Acts as we've been going through where it says, you know, Paul passed through here and he passed through here and he went through Macedonia, encouraging the disciples to continue in the faith. And I'm sorry, that was in Asia Minor, but, you know, he passed through different places. And Luke only selects certain places and certain things that happen to include in his history here. But many, many other things happen. So Paul's telling his story. This is going to be a long, long story, right? Telling him all the miracles that occurred and all that. All right, so verse 20. And when they had heard it, that is James and the elders, they glorified the Lord, and they said to him, you know, this is funny. I have to say this is funny because, you know, when Paul is recounting all these wonderful things that God has done through his ministry, it must have sounded a little bit like he was bragging, right? About all these wonderful things that have been done. And obviously Paul wasn't bragging. It was the power of God. It was God working through and in Paul and through his ministry team that all these people had been converted and all these churches had been established and elders had been ordained and, you know, all that Paul had done throughout a large portion of the Roman Empire. But after Paul gets done his speech, what does James and the elders do? They have to start saying, you know, talking about all that's happened there in Jerusalem. So look what he says. You see, brother, how many myriads of the Jews here are there who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. Now, this is an interesting statement. James and the elders in the Jerusalem church were continuing to keep the law of Moses in all of its details, including the festivals, including Sabbaths, including what they ate, all that stuff. They were keeping those things, while all these Gentile churches that Paul had established were not doing those things. That is, they were not, let me put it this way, it's not that they weren't doing them, because in many cases, they may. In many cases, many of the Gentiles may have decided to eat kosher. Okay, I'm not saying they didn't do it. What I'm saying is they were not required to do those things in order to be Christians. And not only in order to be Christians, but in order to be good Christians. All right, they were not required to do those things. And that's what the Jerusalem Council had said earlier. But now James and the elders want to give the flip side of that. Right? That is, the congregation in Jerusalem had exploded in numbers. It had gone from, well, there was 3,000 who were converted on the day of Pentecost. Right now, of course, many of them had come from other areas. But in Acts chapter 5, I believe it is, there were 5,000 more who were converted in Jerusalem. And now they quit counting how many thousands of people. This is a mega church. The church in Jerusalem is a mega church now, by this time. All right, it's enormous. Now, I'm not saying they had this enormous building, you know, with stadium seating, you know, some big fancy multi-million-dollar complex. No, they didn't have any of that stuff. Remember, they met from house to house. So what they've got is they've got the leadership that meets together on a regular basis. But then they've got groups of people, small groups, that are meeting in homes, in hundreds and hundreds of homes, all over the area of Jerusalem and Judea, that are in subjection to the leadership, the elders, James and the elders, right? Those are their leaders. But they are meeting together in all these small groups in homes. And by the way, that's how the early churches functioned. They didn't have buildings. They didn't have elaborate buildings. They met in homes, and it was a very personal way of interacting with each other by meeting in each other's homes, as opposed to modern Christianity, which meets in a dedicated building, a church building, where we are not bringing, you know, our friends and our fellow Christians into our home. Let's see, the early Christians weren't like that. See, the problem with a church building is it becomes a neutral place. But the early Christians didn't have neutral places where they met. They met in people's homes, and no doubt they rotated around homes, especially in the larger homes that were able to support larger numbers of people. And they had common meals together. That's how the early church functioned, okay? Anyway, and we'll see that was true all the way up to the time when the last apostle died, the apostle John. I believe it's in 2 John, he talks about the church that met in a certain person's house, right? He names the person, you know, the church that meets in their house. Paul talked about the church that met in the house of Aquila and Priscilla. The Philippian church met, I believe it was, met in the house of Priscilla and Aquila. So, we see that this is the way the early churches were established. They were never intended originally to have a dedicated building, a dedicated facility that was the church building. All right, they met in homes, and that helped keep them close as a family. While when you go to the big mega churches today, you know, you can walk in there. You can go every Sunday for 6 months and never see the same people twice, right? That's not fellowship. Fellowship is when it's one-on-one, when it's very personal, when people, other fellow Christians of the area become part of your family. All right, that's what real church, New Testament church, looks like. Anyway, it says, so here we have James and the elders. They get done listening to Paul's recounting all that God has done through his ministry. And no doubt he mentioned to them the fact that he took that letter that they had given him when he was back in Jerusalem previously, you know, where they told the Gentiles that they didn't need to observe all those things. And he told them about, you know, what a great letter that was and how that it had a good impact on the Gentiles, that they weren't putting all this load of having to do all these things that the Jews were required to do, that they didn't have to do that, that the gospel was cross-cultural. The gospel could be adapted to, you know, the Greek culture. The gospel could be adapted to the Roman culture. The gospel could be adapted to all kinds of cultures when you don't bring in the unnecessary things, all right? You bring in the necessary things that are required for us to please God. And you incorporate them into the culture without destroying the culture that they already have. Unless it's pagan, of course, the pagan stuff has to go. But the rest of the culture remains intact. And unfortunately, it's by not doing that is one of the reasons why some missionary activity has been very limited. It's, you know, a lot of mission organizations, they send out clones of, you know, of Americans to go into other cultures and to try to get them not to just bring the gospel, but to bring the American culture into those other nations and other cultures. And so they want the people to dress like Americans and use American type of music in their worship, and you know, and you know, employ American habits of living and stuff like that. you know, dietary things and all that kind of stuff. And that's not how Paul did it at all. In fact, Paul said in Corinthians that, you know, to the Jew, I was like a Jew and I was with the Jews. But to the Greeks, I became like them so that I would not hinder the message of the gospel. And so that's what he did. He adapted the essentials of the gospel and what it takes to please God. He adapted it to the various cultures where he went. And so Christianity actually looked different in Corinth than it did in Jerusalem, or that it did, you know, in Ephesus or in Samaria. It looked different when you went from place to place because of the cultural differences. Christianity embraced the cultures, minus the paganism, but brought the message of what it is required to be pleasing to God and acceptable to God. All right, so anyway, I kind of went off on a tangent there. Anyway, Paul, it says here, but James and the others, the elders, they repeated to Paul after they listened to his speech about all the wonderful things God had done among the Gentiles. They say to him, you see, brother, how many myriads of Jews, that's innumerable, of Jews there are who have believed. And they are all zealous for the law. Now, what they were telling Paul is the Jews who have embraced Christ and have become part of the Jerusalem church are... they have not abandoned any of the rituals, the food requirements, any of those things. They haven't abandoned them because, you know, it's one thing to say that the Gentiles are not required to do that. It's another thing to say that the Jews must abandon those things. And that's not the case, because what we'll see here is that there's a middle ground. There's a middle ground between the Jews who observe the festivals, and no doubt many of them felt compelled to do that because they were raised in the law of Moses their entire lives, right? So you've got that group. The extreme of that group are the ones who went out, you know, from the church saying that Gentiles must do these things. And then you've got on the other extreme, you've got the churches that Paul founded, where they were given permission, even by the Jerusalem church, that they didn't have to do any of those things, right? They just had to do certain central things that were part of, you know, the commands God gave Noah and so forth. Right, so now what's happening now is, because of Paul's ministry throughout the Gentiles, you know, word gets around, rumors fly, people react. And so they say to Paul, look, brother, okay, we accept your message to the Gentiles that it is exactly what God wants to be preached to the Gentiles. However, now you guys are on our turf. Now you guys are in the heart of Israel. You're in the city of Jerusalem, and our church in Jerusalem functions a little differently than your churches in Ephesus or Corinth or Athens or Thessalonica or, you know, any of these other places. Our church here functions a little differently. Now look what happens. It says, he says, all these thousands and thousands of, you know, the congregation members in the church at Jerusalem, the congregation of Jerusalem, he says, all of them are zealous for the law. That is, they are not going to quit doing the things contained in the law of Moses. But they have been informed about you, verse 21, that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not circumcise their children nor walk according to the customs, that is, the customs of the law of Moses. Now, was that statement true? See, there was a rumor, and they're talking about this rumor. So now Paul's in town, and there's a rumor that's gone all through the thousands of members at the church in Jerusalem that Paul's message is not only to the Gentiles that you don't have to keep the law of Moses, but it's also that the Jewish portion of these churches that are among the Gentiles. Now, again, you may remember that when Paul established churches, very often, like let's take the church of Ephesus, for example. When he established a church in Ephesus, it was a split from the synagogue of the Jews, right? Many of the Jews in the synagogue. Paul reasoned there in the synagogue 3 months, and then many of them believed, and then when some were hardened, it says Paul separated the disciples, that is, those who embraced the gospel of Christ. He separated them, and he went to this other location, which they borrowed a school of a man named Tyrannus, and Paul taught them, and then Gentiles were added to them. So they started a church that was a mix of a Jewish core from the synagogue and then all these Gentiles being added. And so all these churches that Paul established had, in many cases, they at least started with a majority of Jews, and then more Gentiles were being added, right? So when Paul took the message, when Paul took the letter that was written back in Acts 15 from this very same elders at Jerusalem and James, and Peter was present at the time, and the letter that they wrote that the Gentiles need not keep the law, the mistake here is that the all these members of the church in Jerusalem were assuming that when Paul took that letter around and he was teaching all these churches among the Gentiles that they did not need to keep the law or observe any of the customs of the law of Moses, that he was saying that not only the Gentiles in these churches, but also the Jews, not only that, but the Jewish core of these churches, that Paul was, they thought that Paul was compelling the Jewish church, leadership and the Jewish core of these churches to quit eating kosher, to quit observing the Sabbath, to quit keeping the festivals, or any of those things. Now, did Paul do that? No, he didn't do that. In fact, it's clear, as we have seen through, as we've gone through Acts, that even back at Troas, when Paul was on his way, making his way back to Jerusalem, that even at Troas, the church gathered together and observed the festival of first fruits. That is the anniversary of Jesus' resurrection, which was on the day of first fruits, which was one of the festivals of the commandments in the law of Moses. So the church got together and observed that. Not only, now for the Jews that were in the church of Troas, not only, they were, you know, in their minds, they were observing the festival that God had ordained through Moses. But it was also the anniversary of the day that Jesus rose from the dead. And so the Gentiles were keeping that as well as the anniversary of the day Jesus rose from the dead. So, you know, the church in Troas is observing this festival, and there's no conflict between the Jewish and the Gentile portion. They could observe it together. You know, the Jews doing it because they had been raised in that from childhood, the Gentiles doing it because they understood the significance of it. They understood how important the significance of it, and that Jesus rose from the dead on that day, and what that really meant, and what first fruits was about, and how it symbolically pointed to Christ and to the resurrection. So the Gentiles were keeping that festival not out of obligation, but because of what it represented for them and how it inspired them. And they loved to keep first fruits because it was, you know, we Christians today keep Easter. And I said last time that Easter is not when Jesus was resurrected, at least most of the time. It doesn't fall on the correct day, and sometimes not even the correct month. All right. But it was the festival of first fruits. All right. So anyway, the rumor that had gone around the church in Jerusalem was that Paul was compelling the Jewish portion of these churches that were scattered throughout the empire that they must stop the festivals, that they must stop, you know, keeping the Sabbath day, that they must stop eating kosher, that they need to eat pork, you know, stop circumcising their children, things like that. So, verse 22. So, now, they obviously knew that that wasn't true, right? But they had inferred it from the fact that the Jerusalem Council previously had given them this letter, which was going around to the Jerusalem churches, okay? So, they continue. They say, what then? The assembly must certainly meet. That is, the whole congregation. They're going to meet in homes. For they will hear that you have come. So they had a problem with Paul. The congregation of Jerusalem had a problem with Paul. At least a great percentage of them did. Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. Take them and be purified with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads and that all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. Now, did Paul keep the law? Yes, he did. Did Paul eat kosher? Yes. Did Paul observe the Sabbath? Yes. See, whenever, as he said in Corinthians, whenever he was among the Jews, he lived according to the law of Moses. Whenever he was among the Gentiles, he didn't feel compelled to live according to the law of Moses. But now here he is among the Jews. And in order to put this rumor to rest that Paul was overthrowing the law of Moses for the Jews who were living, who were going, you know, who were attending these churches that Paul had established among the Gentiles, to show that that rumor was false, and it was false, they were asking Paul to participate in some of the rituals of the law of Moses and to do so publicly. Now, it says here that they had four men who had taken a, that's in the past. And so they say to him, look, take them, take those four guys, you go with them to the temple, be purified with them. And purification was a process that took place at the temple, all right, a ritual. And pay their expenses. Now, what does that mean? It was to, they had to purchase animals to sacrifice. So that they may shave their heads. What? What's this about? And that all may know that the things which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. Now, what's important about this, I want you to skip back, keep your finger here, and skip back to Acts chapter 18. All right, go back to Acts 18, and this is sometime earlier. It says in verse 18. Chapter 18, verse 18. So Paul still remained a good while, and when he had, when he took leave of the brethren, he sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. This is after he left Philippi. Now notice this. This is the last part of verse 18. He had his hair cut off, and now literally it means he shaved his head at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. Now, people look at that and they say, okay, wait a minute. Paul took a vow and he shaved himself bald. Why would Paul take a vow and shave himself bald? Well, he, what Paul was doing there, even while he's out among the Gentiles at Cenchrea, he's out in the Gentile territory. Why would he shave his head to take a vow? Well, if you go, turn in your Bibles back to Numbers chapter 6, this was part of the law of Moses, that there was a certain kind of a vow that a Jewish man or even a woman could take to God. And it was a vow of dedicating themselves completely to God. It was to separate themselves from everything secular, to separate themselves from everything common, and to take a vow at the beginning, and this was for a predetermined period of time of their choosing. All right, they could take the vow for 6 months, they could take the vow for 1 month, they could take the vow for a year, they could take the vow for 10 years. You know, you may remember the story of Samson in the Old Testament. The reason Samson's hair was so long is because the Bible says he was a Nazarite. A Nazarite means a person who has taken the Nazarite vow. That was Samson was, when it says he was a Nazarite, it means it was between the time he had taken the vow and the ending of his vow. So he had taken a really long vow, all right, to be a Nazarite. Taking a Nazarite vow was not normally for life. All right? It was for a specified period of time. Now, the way this vow works, if you let's go to number six, and I know I'm out of time, but I want to just touch on a couple of quick verses in number six. This, in fact, when you get home, read through Numbers chapter six, because it gives all the ins and outs of the Nazarite vow. All right, but it says in verse 2, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of the Nazarite and separate himself to the Lord. And then it says, he shall separate himself from wine or similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar. And it goes on to list things that were required during the term of your Nazarite vow. And one of them obviously was no alcohol of any kind, not even a little bit. You couldn't touch a dead body. Even if your parents died, you couldn't go to the funeral, basically. Right? You had to keep separated from dead things, dead animals, things of that nature. It says, verse 5, all the days of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head. That is, he can't get a haircut. Until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself. So he's the one who designates the term, how long he would be separated to God for this vow. All right. Then he shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. And it goes on to talk about that. Verse 8, all the days of his separation, he shall be holy to the Lord. It talks in verse 9 about his consecrated head. All right. And then it goes on to talk about what happens if accidentally he touches a dead body or something like that. Then he's got to start over, basically. He's got to start over from day one. He's got to go to the temple. He's got to offer a sacrifice because he sinned and went back on his vow. And then he's got to shave off his head, and shave off all his hair, and start over. All right. But I want you to go down to verse 13. Now this is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, that is the days of his vow, this term that he has designated to be separated to God, where he doesn't get a haircut during the entire time, right? He shaves his head at the beginning, and then he lets his hair grow, and he doesn't cut it until he comes to the end of his vow. So, you know, if his vow is for a year or 2 years or 3 years, he's going to have pretty long hair. Right? It might be halfway down his back. It might be way down his back. All right, he's going to have really long hair. He's probably wearing a ponytail. All right. Anyway, it says, he shall be brought to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and he shall present his offering to the Lord. Now, notice what the offering is. This is part of his vow. This is how he completes his vow. And remember, Paul took the vow sometime earlier, right, on his second missionary journey, I believe it was. And here he is now, he made his way to Jerusalem, and his hair has not been cut the entire time. And it's been a long time. All right, so he's on his way to Jerusalem, and Paul's got long, long hair. When he gets to Jerusalem, he's got long, long hair. And why did he want to be in Jerusalem for Pentecost? Because he wanted to complete his vow. His vow was until the day of Pentecost that year. All right? So it says, he shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb in the first year. A male lamb in the first year would be obviously less than 1 year old. Within the first year means it's less than a year old. It's anywhere from just born to just before its birthday. All right, so one male ear of the first year without blemish as a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb. Now, that's a ewe lamb is a female lamb. All right, so he's taking a male lamb, baby male lamb, and a baby female lamb in its first year without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering. Now, a ram is a full-grown male sheep, right? All right, so he's got three animals to be sacrificed in order to complete his vow. Two little lambs, less than a year old, a male and a female, and one full-grown adult male lamb, a ram. Verse 15, a basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, unleavened wafers anointed with oil, and their grain offering with their drink offering. Now, when he brings all this stuff, he's got to bring three animals to the priest to complete his vow. Okay? Now, remember, in Acts 21, they tell Paul, they noticed that he had long hair, and really long hair, and so they noticed that he had taken a Nazarite vow. And so they said, look, we've got four other guys who have done the same thing, and it's time for them to complete their vow as well. And so, they say, take these other four guys with you, and you go to the temple, and you pay their expenses, which means they had to buy the animals to sacrifice. All right, and then, everybody will know that you are walking according to the law of Moses. All right, so what do? They go to do this very thing that we see here in Numbers. They each have to have three animals. That's 15 animals if you count Paul, right? Four guys and Paul times three. Four times three is 12. No, five, counting Paul, 15. All right. Anyway, then the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering. That's the female baby lamb, which it mentioned in back in verse 13 and 14. And the burnt offering, that was the male baby lamb. And he shall offer the ram, and that was the adult male lamb, as a sacrifice of the peace offering to the Lord with a basket of unleavened bread, and the priest shall offer its grain offering and its drink offering. Then the Nazarite, now notice this, this is what's important. Here's Paul, him and these other four guys, four Jews, all had taken Nazarite vows. They all go to the temple at the same time to complete their vow. Their vows are all expiring at the same time. Now, how did that happen? Because it was typical for a Jew, if he made a vow, to make the completion date of his vow on one of the festivals, because males had to go to Jerusalem anyway to keep the festivals, right? So if he's going to do that, he wouldn't want to have to make a special trip to Jerusalem from someplace far away. He would do it during one of the festivals. So he would be in Jerusalem anyway for Pentecost. And so that's these other four guys. Their vows were expiring on Pentecost also. All right, there were probably many others of the Jerusalem church who had vows, but their vows weren't set to expire at the same time that Paul's was on Pentecost. All right, so then the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head. That is, all this hair, he shaved it when he took the vow, so he was completely bald at the beginning of his term. His hair is growing the entire time. The growth of hair represents the passage of time, because hair grows at a certain rate, right? In fact, a lot of times when people go to get a drug test, they'll take a hair and they analyze the hair, because they analyze the hair from the root all the way to the end, because that is a record of time. And certain chemicals in certain drugs will affect your hair at a certain time. So not only can they tell if you have been taking certain drugs, but they can tell how long ago you took those drugs by your hair, right? Well, with this, it was from the moment that they shaved their head to take their vow, their hair was growing, and it represented the history of the length of time that their head was consecrated to God. And so now they are with their long hair, they're at the temple, they got their animals to sacrifice. And so it says, the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head, this big ball of hair that, if it's been a long time, it's a big ball of hair, and put it in the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. and the priest shall take the boiled shoulder of the ram, and so forth. Then it goes on to say how the priest is going to take a portion of the animal that's killed and wave it before the Lord. And then it says, in the end of verse 20, it says, and after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. That is, his vow of separating himself to the Lord is over, and now he can go back to living a normal life. All right? Now, this is what it means to take the Nazarite vow, and this is exactly what was happening here in Acts 21. All right? So, let me just wrap this part of it up so you understand fully that when the Apostle Paul went to Jerusalem, it was to keep his vow. It was to complete his vow. It was to shave his head and offer his animal sacrifices at the temple in accord with the law of Moses. Now, was Paul compelled by the law of Moses to do these things? No. First of all, the Nazarite vow is voluntary. But secondly, the law of Moses itself did not require Paul to do this, because Paul, when he wrote the book of Hebrews, he tells very plainly that the new covenant has superseded the law of Moses. But this is, you know, it was through the law of Moses that the Jews had worshiped God their entire lives, and so they continued to do that. Even after becoming Christians, they continued to do all the things that were required in the law of Moses up until the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. In AD 70, the Romans completely destroyed Jerusalem, disbanded the priesthood, and made these things impossible, because there was no temple to take your hair to or to bring your sacrifices to. There was no longer a priesthood. You couldn't keep the festivals in the way that it was commanded under the law of Moses, because all of those required the priesthood. All right? It was wiped out. But anyway, verse 24, it says, take them and be purified with them, that and pay their expenses, so that they may shave their heads along with you, Paul. You're going to shave off all this hair you've been growing. You're going to shave it off, and they're going to do the same thing. So, you know, all you guys go do that together, and it's a public thing, all right? And that they all may know, that is the whole congregation, in other words, those who see that this happens, and these other four guys who do it are going to know that Paul went with them, and that Paul completed his vow at the same time they did. And so they all may know, you know, rumors will spread really fast. They all may know that the things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. And Paul did do that, right? When he was with Israel, he kept, when he was with the Jewish Christians, he kept the law. But concerning, now notice this is important, verse 25. But concerning the Gentiles who believe, we have written, and he's talking about the Jerusalem Council and the letter that they wrote back in Acts 15. We have written and decided that they should observe no such thing, except that they should keep themselves from things offered to idols, from blood, and from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. So did Paul comply with this? Yes, he did. Verse 26. Then Paul took the men the next day, having been purified with them, entered the temple to announce the expiration of the days of purification, at which time an offering should be made for each one of them. Now when the 7 days were almost ended, now this is the 7 days of the expiration that these rituals took place. Now we're going to stop right there. We're going to pick it up next time, and we're going to see that when Paul went to the temple, it started a riot because of the unbelieving Jews, not because of the Jewish Christians, all right, who had been misinformed, but because of the unbelieving Jews and what they had been informed about Paul. And it causes a riot at the temple, and this is what's going to lead to Paul's arrest. So next time we'll pick that up, and we'll talk about Paul's arrest. We'll talk about the riot, first of all, that started at the temple. We'll talk about Paul's speech that he gave in his defense at the temple in the Aramaic language. In other words, speaking to the Jews in the language that they normally spoke in a speech that he gave. And then his arrest, and which is going to lead to his trial later in his imprisonment. All right? So that's it for now. I know I went really long today. I apologize for that. But it's good stuff, isn't it? All right? All right, God bless you all, and we'll see you next week.